In 2018, the body of 24-year-old Toya Cordingley was found on a secluded beach in Australia's far north. Now, the man accused of her murder is facing trial. Rajwinder Singh has pleaded not guilty, and in the case of Toya's murder, we'll bring you all the details from the courtroom as he fights the charges in this highly anticipated trial. Search for the Case Of podcast in the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
This is normally how it goes. A new government gets elected on a wave of popular anger. The new leader is a bombastic, colourful dude with interesting hair who throws aside all that wishy-washy, we're all in this together stuff of his predecessor, and he tells it like it is, or like his supporters see it. But the people who didn't vote for him, the journalists who question his decisions and investigate how he might be enriching himself in office, well, such people are dangerous and disloyal. Didn't they see who won the election? And bit by bit, the courts are captured. The media is silenced. People start disappearing off the streets, and the legions of supporters of the dear leader threaten violence against anyone who speaks up against him. Around 30 years ago, the world had a real democratic moment when democracy seemed not only desirable, but inevitable in most countries. But something's gone badly wrong in the interim, and we're looking at what's called a democratic recession around the world. James Loxton is here today. James has made this his life's work. James began his working life as a shepherd in Canada, I'm not making this up, then went out into the world, into India and Chile. And now James is a senior lecturer at Sydney University, where he specialises in how authoritarian regimes come to power, but also how they can crumble. He's written a new book called Authoritarianism, a very short introduction. Hello, James.
Hi, Richard.
You know, there's that old, threadbare old quote of Winston Churchill's about democracy being the worst form of government apart from all the others that have been tried from time to time. I have a theory, and this is just pure intuition on my part. I suspect that in most democracies, perhaps even here, there's about, I don't know, a quarter of the population that doesn't much like democracy. They don't like the rancor in the parliament, the back and forth. They much rather see a strong man come forward and just cut through all that stuff and take over. You've probably got access to better research than my intuition. What do you think of all that, James?
I'm not sure I could put a figure on it, but what I do know is that in every country, including Australia, there are always some people who don't believe in democracy. In fact, who would like to see that democracy die. So we have this old idea that comes from the Brits of the loyal opposition, you know, so right now Labour is in power and the coalition is the loyal opposition, you know, they oppose the government, but they support the regime. There are always people, though, who are disloyal to the regime, who would like to see that democracy die. Sometimes that figure can get quite high. Sometimes it's quite low. Fortunately, in Australia, I think it's pretty low at the moment. But, you know, what if we had an economic depression? What if something really, really bad happened here? The disloyal opposition might start to become more popular.
What are the symptoms of a democracy that's going bad? The democracy that's starting to look like it's about to decline and go down another path?
You know, you can survey people and ask them, and actually there are bodies that do this all around the world. You know, do you think that democracy is the best system of government? So if people are starting to become discontent with democracy, you might have more people who are answering yes. But what I find to be more worrying is when you have politicians who run for office who are extreme in their rhetoric, who are explicitly anti-democratic, but they're not just fringe figures anymore. They start to become really popular figures. My old mentor, Stephen Levitsky, he wrote the book How Democracies Die. He's one of the experts on these things. And he is, and his co-author, Daniel Ziblatt, they came up with a sort of a litmus test that we should all be on the lookout for. Politicians who could potentially, if elected, kill democracy, destroy democracy. So he says, for example, if they openly endorse violence, that's a bit of a red flag. If they say that they won't accept the results of the election unless they win, that is a bit of a red flag. If they threaten civil liberties, for example, if they say that they might shut down the media if elected, that is a red flag. So those are the things that we really need to be on the lookout for.
Is this democratic backsliding more likely to take place in places that have a history of it, like Latin America or Eastern Europe, than other places that have got a more established tradition of democracy?
Well, to answer that question, I think we need to back up a little bit. And because I think it's really important for listeners in Australia and other apparently stable democracies to understand that democracy is always fragile. And it can die in different ways. So when we imagine democracy dying, I think a lot of us imagine a military coup. You know, in Thailand, every 10 or 15 years, they have a military coup. There was a military coup in Madagascar. My wife is from Chile. There was a coup in 1973. She spent the first 10 years of her life living under an awful military dictatorship. Coups still happen. That is one way that democracy can die, at the hands of men with guns. But democracy can also die at the hands of men in suits. And yes, it is almost always men. People who run for office are elected fairly, squarely, democratically, and then use the power of the state to destroy democracy from within. And we can actually go back to, you know, one of the worst dictators in history, which, of course, is Adolf Hitler, who came to power after winning not one, but two democratic elections in 1932, became Chancellor Hitler. You can actually see pictures of him wearing a suit, just looking like a somewhat normal politician before he, created this awful regime.
Is it nearly always a man, or are we starting to see women emerge now in an age where women have greater equality with men as these new interesting leaders with interesting hair?
So it is almost always a man, that's true. But in recent years, we have started to see some female dictators emerge. So the current president of Tanzania, Samia Suluhu Hassan, is a woman. Until recently, the dictator of Bangladesh, Sheikh Hasina, was a woman. And the current co-president, I'm not making this up, of Nicaragua is named Rosario Murillo. And she is the wife of the country's now longtime dictator, Daniel Ortega. So he was elected, started pushing the country into authoritarianism, decided to make the first lady his vice president. And then he would start saying in public, kind of, you know, he'd say, you know, she's not really just a vice president. She's more like a co-president. And everybody would laugh and say, oh, very good, Mr. President. And he would, and then he started to say, no, but like, seriously, she's the co-president. And people didn't quite know how to respond. And then eventually he just ordered the legislature to change the constitution to officially declare her co-president. So now you have co-presidente Ortega and co-presidenta Murillo.
Do they tend to set up themselves as monarchies after a while? That seems to be a common thing, like the Marcos family, Kim Il-sung's family in North Korea. There does seem to be a tendency to suddenly the president is a monarch rather than an elected figure.
There aren't that many examples that I know of personalist dictators, as they're called, literally declaring themselves monarchs. I mean, Napoleon did it. The first Shah of Iran did it. Maybe the weirdest case of all is the Central African Republic, where the dictator there, Bokassa, changed the name of Central African Republic to Central African Empire and declared himself Emperor Bokassa. But often they just rule as though they were monarchs without technically becoming monarchs.
Right. I happen to have this incredibly gifted son or wife. Yeah. Who really needs to follow in my footsteps if they've been studying me very, very closely.
Although I'll tell you something, Richard, and this might come as a surprise. These days, hereditary democracy is at least as common as hereditary autocracy. It is exceedingly common for the children or wives or siblings occasionally of prime ministers and presidents to themselves get elected to office. I did the count, and if you exclude monarchies, there were more democracies where the prime minister president was the child or spouse of a former head of government than there were autocracies. Places like Canada, you know, Justin Trudeau, right?
And in the United States with the Bush family as well.
Or Estonia, the current prime minister of Estonia, or Greece, or Guatemala, or a number of countries.
You wrote this book in 2024,
yeah.
And there was an interesting presidential election taking place in the United States.
Yeah.
Well, you obviously were keeping a close eye on that as you were writing your book and maybe updating it as you were going along. What were you observing during that 24 election? Has it made it a bit different from the 2016 election when Donald Trump first got elected into the presidency?
Well, I spend most of my time studying Latin America, so Mexico all the way down to the bottom end of South America, the 19 Spanish and Portuguese-speaking countries of the Americas. And something that I will tell you about Trump is that he's not an original figure. He is a run-of-the-mill Latin American populist. He is the Juan Perón of the North. He is, you know, an English-speaking Hugo Chavez.
So he's not a one-off at all. He's a very recognizable figure for a 100%. Student of Latin America.
I mean, he has his eccentricities, yeah, as they all do. But, you know, these outsider politicians who run on some message where they're going to crush the elites and bring power to the people, this is depressingly commonplace in the countries that I study. And I used to actually struggle sometimes in my classes here at Sydney Uni to teach my Australian students who have had the good fortune of growing up in a stable democracy, you know, to explain the phenomenon of populism. And now I just say, you see Trump, that's what it is. He is the quintessential populist. But again, for people who study Latin America, a very recognizable figure.
The election results in Australia and in Canada that came after Trump had made his tariff announcement in particular was seen, fairly or unfairly, was seen as a rebuke by larger numbers of Australians and Canadians against Trump and Trumpism. What makes Australia and Canada so distinctly different from the United States? I think we're used to comparing ourselves a bit too easily and glibly with America, but what makes us very different? And I think you probably have a very interesting point of view on this, being Canada-born as you are.
Culturally, I don't think that they are that different. I mean, you'd be hard-pressed to find, you know, three more similar countries in the world than the United States, Canada, and Australia. And I say this as someone who grew up in Canada, lived in the United States and did all of his higher studies there, and has now lived in Australia for 10 years. These countries all share a lot in common at the cultural level. But when it comes to politics, they really are quite different. And one of the big differences is that the United States has a presidential system. And this is something actually that political scientists have spent a lot of time thinking about, spilt a lot of ink over. And there's pretty much an overwhelming consensus that presidentialism is just an awful system, just a terrible, terrible system, and that parliamentarism is a much more functional system. So that is one notable difference that we have.
And the upshot of that is that parliamentary systems, do they tend to drive politics more towards the centre as opposed to more entrenched camps that eye each other with mutual hatred? Is that what happens?
I think for me, the biggest difference is that it's actually quite easy to get rid of a prime minister, but it's very hard to get rid of a president. So I would say that in Australia, we've gone a bit overboard on this, to be honest. Gillard overthrowing Rudd overthrowing Gillard, Turnbull overthrowing Abbott, Morrison overthrowing Turnbull. It got a bit ridiculous in Australia for a while with the leadership spills. But the tool of a leadership spill or the tool of a vote of no confidence is extremely handy when you have someone who is dangerous and or unpopular. It's a big deal when we remove a prime minister, but it is not the same kind of national trauma it is that when you remove a president like Park Geun-hye in South Korea or
Richard Nixon in the United States. Yes.
Exactly.
You grew up in Canada, like I say. Which part of Canada did you grow up in, James?
I grew up in British Columbia, which is the westernmost province of Canada. And actually, it's kind of like the WA of Canada, if you will, in that it's most Canadians live out on the east, just like most Australians do. But then you have this, big city of Vancouver and other smaller cities around there out on the west coast. And so I grew up in British Columbia.
Not in Vancouver, though, were you?
No, I was born in Victoria, which confusingly is on Vancouver Island. Vancouver is not on Vancouver Island. Victoria is. And Victoria is actually the provincial capital. It's a city of about 300,000 people, and that's where I was born and lived as a child.
And what was your dad doing for work?
So my dad is Australian, actually, and he left Australia as a young man and went backpacking around the world. He met my mom as a young man at a youth hostel, I think, in London, and then they ended up getting married and settling in Canada. So he grew up on a farm here in Australia. He worked in shearing sheds. He worked as a cowboy, did all sorts of things, and then eventually got into tree planting in Canada, which is a big industry in British Columbia. You know, they log the trees, then they have to plant new trees, and ended up building a pretty successful tree planting company, actually.
How did he talk about Australia with you as a kid?
All the time. So, I'm the child of an immigrant. And
oh, it was the old country, was it? Right.
It was the old country. Right. Yeah. And not only was it the old country, it was the country that we were moving back to, quote unquote, anytime. And we would all roll our eyes because I was not an Australian kid. My two older brothers were not Australian kids. We were Canadian, but he would talk about it all the time and do the kind of weird things that immigrant parents will sometimes do to kind of build up this idea of the old country. So, you know, someone whose parents are from India might make their daughter learn classical Indian dance, or someone whose parents are from Ireland.
What did you do? What was your...
I had to memorize poems by Banjo Patterson. I am not joking. To this day, I can recite The Man from Ironbark from beginning to end. It's actually a good poem.
You had your mum... went through a very difficult time. What can you tell me a bit about her?
Yeah, so my mom was a very, 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 very severe alcoholic and ended up on the street and eventually drinking herself to death. So she ended up having a very sad life. But of course, she wasn't always like that. Right. And so by all accounts, when I was a very small kid, she was... a wonderful person and a wonderful mother. And sometimes when I ask myself, why is it that I have turned out as well as I have? I think a lot of it must have to do with that, because I think those early childhood experiences, even the ones you don't remember, or perhaps especially the ones you don't remember, they actually have a profound influence on your life. So I think when I was a little kid, she was basically, not basically, I think she was a very good mother, but then it started to creep up on her more and more and more. And by the time I was maybe about 8 years old, that was just the all-consuming fact of my family's life.
Would she change when she was on the drink?
Totally. So for people who have never lived with addicts, it can be difficult to understand what it's like. And actually, alcoholism comes in many different forms. Some alcoholics are more functional or dysfunctional than others. Some are nicer or meaner than others. The way that I put it is I say to people, you know, think of, you know, your favorite movie about heroin addicts. There's tons of movies about that. Maybe that's The Basketball Diaries or...
Trainspotting.
Or maybe not Trainspotting, because that provides sort of a more romantic view, but Requiem for a Dream or something like that. Now imagine that's your mom. That's what it's like. So she was deeply dysfunctional, and when she was drinking, just had a special talent for saying and doing the worst possible thing. So that was life for me from around age eight to age 11.
What approaches did the family take to her when she was getting worse?
So, you know, I was just a little kid, so I just went along with it. But my dad had the idea that we could save her, you know. And so, and my brothers and I were enlisted into these different attempts to save her. So sometimes that meant, okay, we're all going to just be extra nice to her to show her how much we love her, and then she'll realize that she's on the wrong track and she'll stop drinking. Well, that didn't work. Then, okay, we're going to all be extra, you know, rude to her to show her how much she's alienating us, and that way, you know, she'll realize that she's on the wrong path and stop drinking. Of course, none of these things worked. And I've actually told my wife, Julieta, I'm happily married, but I've told her, if I ever become an alcoholic or an addict of any kind, just leave me. Like, just get out early. You cannot do anything to help an addict unless they really, really want to be helped. If they really, really want to be helped and make the effort necessary to be helped, well, then, of course, you should support them. But you can't make them make that first decision.
Did your parents split anyway as a result?
Yeah, my parents split. When you live in this kind of extraordinarily dysfunctional environment like I did, dysfunction builds upon dysfunction. And so there were a lot of things going on. We were kind of like the problem people in our street. You know, the cops went to our house pretty often, late night screaming matches and all this kind of stuff. And things really came to a head when I was 11 years old. My brothers had left at this point. One was in university. One was, I don't know where he was. My dad was gone at that point. So it's just me and my mom, and things were really, really bleak. But I still had this idea in my mind that, you know, we could save her, right? So she came home one night, driving home, just stumbling drunk, started going up the stairs, just passed out on her face. And I know this is going to sound crazy, Richard, but this was so normal for me that this was not shocking. This was just, you know, what else is new? Mom is passed out on her face. But using the logic of a child, I thought, if she goes to prison, then she won't be able to drink alcohol, then she'll stop drinking alcohol, then she'll come good. She has clearly been driving. Drinking and driving is illegal, so I'm going to call the cops and, you know, set this plan in motion. But I didn't want to disturb anybody too much. I mean, this wasn't an emergency. This was just a pretty standard thing in my life. So I actually flipped through the phone book to find the non-emergency number for the police. Again, I'm 11 years old. I didn't want to dial the equivalent of 000. I found the non-emergency number, called the police. Of course, it was an emergency because they were viewing it as adults, not as a child immersed in this bizarre environment. So after that, I left home. I went and stayed with some family friends for a while, and then eventually went on with my and lived with my dad.
Did you ever see her again after that?
A few times. She wasn't part of my life in any way after that. She ended up on the street. I think she was actually sleeping rough for a while. I'm not really sure, to be honest. Eventually, she did get into some kind of government accommodation, so she had a place to live. But she spent 2 decades as a street beggar, really. So I would go down to – I moved to a different city at this point, but I would go down to Victoria sometimes to visit my brothers or to visit my friends. But I always knew which street corner to avoid, you know, because her place was in front of the Rogers Chocolates on Government Street, right downtown. And so, you know, I would studiously avoid that corner because, you know, who wants to see their mom like that, right?
So when you moved in with your dad, where did that take you?
So that took me to a place about 600 or 700 kilometers north of the U.S. border, which is where Victoria is. So this is smack dab in the middle of the province. It's a small city, maybe 60, 70,000 people, but pretty rough city. There's a lovely Australian expression that I really like, rough as guts. I'd say this place is rough as guts, and there's a lot of bush towns in Australia that are also rough as guts.
It's a logging town or something?
It was a logging town, right. Yeah. So kind of strip malls and, you know, lots of logging trucks driving through. And I'm sure many people have a great life there, but it was not for me.
How did you become a junior shepherd at this time?
Yeah, so I mentioned that my dad started this tree planting company. It became quite a successful company. And then he decided to pivot from that to a different industry, but still in the general field of silviculture. So logging is a big industry in Canada, just like in, say, Tasmania. You cut down the trees, sell the wood, and then you have to plant new trees. But the problem is that those little trees are competing with other kinds of vegetation. So you've got to keep that other kind of vegetation down if you want the little trees to grow. So the main way that they deal with that is just by spraying chemicals, herbicide. But there are some places that are considered more environmentally precarious. And in those cases, one of the options is to bring in a big flock of sheep.
All right, like lawnmower.
Exactly. Right. It's a lawnmower made up of a flock of 1,500 sheep, and you just steer it around, and they eat all the grass. The one thing that they don't eat is the little trees, because just by some fluke of nature, they don't like the taste of little spruce or pine trees.
James, how did you like that, being out in the... I mean, Canada gets pretty damn cold, I know, but nonetheless, was it kind of nice to have the peace of that after the chaos of the early family life?
I would say it was a bit of a mixed bag, Richard. So first of all, this was in the this is in the summer always. Yeah. This is how I spent my summer every year from age 10 until age 19. And you know, summers in Canada actually get hot. So it would be, you know, 30 whatever degrees. In some ways, it was amazing, right? I got to have this experience that almost nobody else would have in these really, really remote places. You know, it might be a 2-hour drive before you come to your first petrol station, much less a town. And it's often very beautiful where you are. You know, rural Canada is very beautiful. We were really far north, like right up on the border with Alaska. We're talking, you know, part of the world where there are bears and wolves and all of this kind of thing. So a lot of that was wonderful. I was spending time with my brothers and some close family friends who also worked with us. But it was also really hard. You know, anyone who has ever worked in agriculture will know that it is not as romantic as we might think.
So this bucolic image I have of a barefoot kid reading a book under a tree while sheep graze happily on the weeds, that's not it. It's sweaty, hard work, is it?
Yeah, so right. We'd wake up at 5, out the door by 5:30, come back at 9 p.m., 9:30. So just extremely long days, chronically sleep deprived. If it rains for a week, you stand in the rain for a week, and just walking nonstop. I'd get in amazingly good shape, actually. That was a really nice part of it.
You said Bears and wolves? Yeah. What did you have to protect you against bears and wolves?
What we had were dogs. We had these big white dogs. We used a couple of different breeds, but the main one, they're called Great Pyrenees. They're kind of like a St. Bernard, that same size. They look similar, but white. And so for a flock of 1,500 sheep, we might have somewhere between 3 and 6 dogs. And these dogs have been used for centuries, maybe even longer.
Are they there to scare off the bear? Yeah, or will they actually attack the bear or the wolf?
So bears in particular, they don't want trouble. Bears actually are omnivores. They spend most of their time grazing on grass and eating berries, and they really just don't want trouble.
So it's mama bear wants to protect her young. That's the danger, isn't it?
That's the danger. Yeah. Or maybe if there's been a bad berry season and they're starving or something like that, then they might think about killing a couple of dogs so that they can get at and eat a couple of sheep. But it almost never happened, actually. It almost never happened. There were a few cases. Again, so each year we would have about 6,000 sheep out in the bush, 4 flocks of 1,500 sheep. It happened a handful of times that sheep were killed by bears, but actually almost never. What would happen all the time is that the dogs would start barking and go running off into the woods chasing something that you couldn't see, but they knew that something was out there, and you could be pretty sure that that was a bear or a wolf.
Did any of your dogs come a cropper against these?
There was one time I remember when it was very stormy out, and the dogs just started freaking out, and they ran off into the bushes, and we didn't know what was happening. And then one of the dogs came back, one of these big white dogs, and it went and it hid under one of the caravans where we would sleep at night, and which was sort of unusual behavior, and it didn't want to come out. And finally we coaxed it out, and I found just like a little hole under its neck, which presumably was a tooth mark, and a wolf must have just bit it right there, right in the place that, you know, it needed to bite it to kill it, and the dog died.
It sounded like you wanted to get out. What was your escape plan for escaping Canadian shepherding, James? And just, I've been doing the show 20 years. I've never asked anyone that question before.
I know. It's not a very common question. Right. And the answer to your question will probably be even less common. So I told you I was living in this pretty rough bush town. Home life was still, it was better than it was before, but it was still not great. So I was pretty keen to get out. I was always a very good student. There was only one year, I think, as a child when things were really bad at home that my marks started to slip. But otherwise, these things always came pretty naturally to me, and I took a lot of pride in it. And around age 14 or 15, I started thinking, okay, what's next? And I'd like to leave sooner rather than later. And so a friend of mine, or the parent of a friend of mine, mentioned this international school called the Pearson United World College. And I had heard of it, but I didn't know what it was. And she said, you know, you should think about applying to that. So I started looking into it. And it turns out that there's a chain of these international schools called United World Colleges all around the world, you know, in Wales and Singapore and Eswatini. And one of those happened to be in Canada. And the most wonderful thing about these schools is that almost everyone goes on a full scholarship. There was no way that I could have, you know, contemplated going to a place like this if I had to pay. That was not in the cards. So I made this my goal. I was going to apply to the United World Colleges, and I put this plan into effect when I was maybe 14 or 15, and just everything was geared towards that, just having the highest marks I possibly could, getting involved in many different extracurricular activities. And so eventually, when I was 16, I applied to the United World Colleges. I got in, and you don't get to choose which one you go to, but you can give your order of preference.
Right.
And at this point, you know, the idea of staying in Canada, I thought, you know, that's a bit boring. What are the other options? And the one that I put as my number one option was the one in India, the Mahindra United World College of India. And off I went at age 17 to spend 2 years in Maharashtra, India, at an international school with students from all over the world.
Wow. And whereabouts in India is this place?
So this is in the state of Maharashtra, which is in the western part of India. That's the state where Mumbai is. And this was outside of a city called Pune, which at that time had about 4 million people. And by Indian standards, this was considered you know, a pretty small city, which is hilarious because that's the size of Melbourne or Montreal. But this, the school itself was actually out in the countryside, and it was up in a low-lying mountain range called the Western Ghats. So the school was up on this mountain looking out over this valley, an agricultural valley, and it's just one of the most beautiful places I've ever been.
What did you know about India, or indeed this place, before you went there?
Absolutely nothing, like really just nothing.
Did you panic when you got there, given that it's so very different, or were you just thrilled
I was thrilled, to be honest. I was so, I'm not going to say it was always easy. You know, I had a girlfriend that I left when I left Canada. I had
you were a Canadian shepherd as well. That's not easy.
Exactly. And so I've up sticks and moved several times in my life now. And I find that the first night lying down, you always just think, what the hell have I done? Like, this seemed like a good idea when it was an abstract thing, but now I'm in Chile or India or Australia or whatever. Why did I think this was a good idea? Believe it or not, when I moved to India, I had never even had Indian food. I had Indian food the night before I left. I went to an Indian restaurant with my girlfriend at the time. I didn't know what to order because I didn't know anything about Indian food. And so I asked the man, who I assume was the owner, you know, what would you recommend? And I mentioned that I was moving to India the next day. And then when it came time to pay the bill, he said, no, it's on the house. You know, you're moving to my country, so it's on us. And I just thought, oh, that's really sweet. But I knew really nothing at all about the place.
So it must have hit you, all of your senses all at once. It's hell of a lot warmer than Western Canada, yeah. And the color, the sound, the food, everything. It must have been sensory overload.
It really was. Yeah, I arrived in late August, early September, so that's full monsoon season, and so it was just, you know, raining, really, really hot, really, really humid. I'd never been in a climate like that, and anyone who has traveled to India will know that it's a pretty chaotic place if you come from a place like Australia or Canada, you know, very full on just in terms of the amount of people that are around you, all of the different smells, all of the different colors, all of the different pollution. It was quite overwhelming, but I actually loved it. Like, I was 17 years old. I was ready for an adventure. I wanted to be in the most different possible environment imaginable. And that was India. I mean, that was the most different environment imaginable.
And in this school, were there other young people like you from all over the world, different places?
Yeah. So there were 200 students at the school. We did the International Baccalaureate, which you can actually do in Australia as well. Of the 200 students, I think there were people from 60 or 70 countries. So just all over, from all over Europe, from all over Asia, from parts of Africa, from all over Latin America, North America.
You would have been there with students who, unlike yourself, had not grown up under a democracy. What kind of stories were you hearing about the kind of governments that these students had come from?
I think it's the natural tendency of everyone to just think that their world is the world. And so I had not given the topic of dictatorship or democracy, for that matter, really any thought. But suddenly there I am in India, and there are students from places like Chile or Uruguay, Peru or Venezuela, places that either had a history of military dictatorship or places that actually at that time were under the control of elected strongmen. And so suddenly I'm hearing stories about people who spent their early lives living in fear, you know, knowing that the military could just pick you up and cart you away at any time.
How did that affect you, hearing these kind of stories as a young person?
It made me curious about it, and it made me interested in learning Spanish. So when I then moved on to university, I had to study a language. That was a requirement of the degree. But I also know myself well enough to know that I will never learn this language properly in a classroom in an English-speaking country. So I'm going to get the basics in class, and then I'm going to, as soon as possible, thrust myself into the discomfort of being in a place where you have to speak the language. Otherwise, you know, you can't do anything. You can't live. So in university, I started spending my summers in Spanish-speaking countries. And then when I finished university, moved to Chile for a year.
And while you were there, Augusto Pinochet, the former dictator of Chile that took power in a coup d'etat in the 1970s, he died. What happened while you were in Santiago when Pinochet died? What did you see?
2006, 2007, I was living in the capital, Santiago de Chile, for 12 months. one of the things that became immediately apparent to me when I moved to this country is that even though it was a democracy, it had been a democracy for over a decade and a half, there were still legacies of the old regime everywhere. For example, one of the big boulevards very close to where I was where I lived was called the 11th of September Avenue. 11th of September, that was the date of the military coup of 1973 that brought Pinochet to power. That was the street name. I thought, okay, that's interesting and strange. And, you know, just talking to people sometimes, you know, I just assumed everyone must think that this man who, in my opinion, was just an awful dictator. I mean, killed thousands of people, tortured tens of thousands, you know, something like a million people forced into exile, some of them in Australia, actually. Everyone must hate this man. And I remember being at a barbecue, you know, and drinking wine and eating meat and saying something about Pinochet. And the guy who I was talking to saying, oh, I actually support Pinochet. And I was thinking, what? Turns out, you know, this was not that fringe of a position. So the thing that brought the Pinochet dictatorship to an end was a plebiscite. In 1988, they held a plebiscite to decide Pinochet, yes or no. Do we want this guy to stay in power for several more years?
And he was confident he'd win that one, wasn't he?
He was confident he would win because dictators are almost always surrounded by sycophants who tell them exactly what they want to hear. So this plebiscite was held. Pinochet thought he was going to win, and he didn't. He lost. But you know what, Richard? It was a lot closer than you might think. So looking back on the past 15 years of forced disappearances and executions and, you know, military rule, 44% of Chileans looked at that and they said, that was really good.
Because he brought economic stability to Chile. That's
they would
the
say
story,
he brought
it?
Economic stability. Yeah. He saved the country from becoming a second Cuba. There was, you know, order. And by the time that he left office, the economy was actually growing pretty fast. The thing about the Chilean economic miracle under Pinochet, that's actually a bit of a myth. The economy didn't grow particularly fast until the very end when it started to grow fast. It was actually under democracy that the economy really took off.
So when he died while you were there, what was the reaction in the street like?
So I was in my apartment, it was December 2006, and suddenly I started hearing honk, 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 and it's just going on and on. I thought, something has happened. So I kind of Googled to find out what had happened. It turned out that Pinochet had died. And I heard that there was a big spontaneous demonstration slash celebration in one of the main squares in the city. And so I went there and there were just thousands of people out, you know, celebrating, drinking beer, you know, dancing, happy that this dictator had died. And I can't say that I blame them. Then the next day, they held a wake for Pinochet in a different part of the city, a richer part of the city. And I thought, you know, Pinochet doesn't die every day. I think I might go to his wake because just out of morbid curiosity, frankly. So off I went. I have never seen a queue that long in my life. Thousands of people had turned out to pay their final respects to Pinochet. They're holding signs that say, you know, gracias mi general, thank you, general. And, you know, for them, he was the savior of the country. So even though Pinochet probably never had the support of a majority of the population, he always had the support of a large, disturbingly large minority of the population.
I think we get to the nub of something that's interesting about human beings with this. And I'm thinking, as you were telling me this, of the masses of weeping mourners at the death of Stalin. I mean, we're getting to the realm of psychology, which might be outside your zone here, but what do you think that's about, James?
Sometimes they have actually accomplished things. You know, in the case of Chile, the economy was growing by the time that Pinochet left office. Sometimes people think they're grateful to the dictator because they think that the dictator saved them from an even worse fate, you know, becoming a second Cuba, or maybe just from anarchy, or maybe from foreign invasion, or whatever the threat was. But I also think that we have a bit of a tendency sometimes to whitewash history. You know, we might think of it as something like the golden age fallacy. I know that sometimes when I think back on aspects of my past, I have, you know, quite fond memories, and then I'll interrogate it a bit more and I'll remember, actually, you know, it was a bit of a mix. I think the same thing happens sometimes when we think back on past leaders, including past dictators. We start to exaggerate how good they really were at their job.
There was a cartoon published around about the time Trump first got elected. It was a wonderful cartoon. It was made in America and had Hilltop with a whole lot of sheep on it, as it turns out, James. And there's a giant billboard in the middle of it. It's like an election billboard. And there's a wolf running for office. The wolf is grinning. He's got a ribbon on his suit. And his slogan is, I will eat you. And the sheep's smiling, really beguiled by it. And he goes, He tells it like it is, like that. What I'm asking you is about some kind of strange animal attraction, or whatever, is it residual chimpanzee in us or something that looks at the strong leader, no matter how much danger he might present to us, and go, oh, that's what I want in my life.
Yeah. I mean, in all democracies, you have people who don't like democracy. And so, you know, that might explain part of the vote for the Trumps of the world or the Chavezes of the world or the Alberto Fujimoris of the world. But I think a lot of people also just – they just don't really think that the person is going to carry through on their promises. Oh, he's not really going to shut down the media, right? He's not really going to change the electoral system to make sure that he can never lose another election. I'm not just talking about Trump now. I'm talking about, you know, generic strongmen. But often these guys actually do what they say. You mentioned Masha Gessen before we started our interview today, and Gessen wrote an essay right after Trump was elected called Rules for Surviving Autocracy. And the first rule was, believe the autocrat. He means what he says. And I think there's really something to that. You know, if somebody says the media are the enemy of the people, elect me and I will shut down the media, we should probably take that seriously. But there's one final thing, Richard, that I find actually quite disturbing, which is that, you know, there are some people who they're not particularly in favor of dictatorship, and they might even believe that if they vote for this person, the country might slide into something less than democracy. But they do it anyways. And why do they do it? It's because, you know, I'm right wing, he's right wing. Yeah, I don't want the country to become a dictatorship, but I would prefer that to the left coming to office.
Or right, he's on my footy team.
He's on my footy team. Yeah, right. Or I'm left wing, he's left wing. Right. I'm going to vote for him no matter what.
You write and talk quite a bit about something that you call, it's a complicated phrase, but competitive authoritarianism. What is competitive authoritarianism?
Yeah, it sounds like a bit of a nonsense term, doesn't it? An oxymoron. It's like saying, you know, light, darkness, or dry water, or something like that. A competitive authoritarian regime is a regime that is a hybrid. It's a mixture of democracy and dictatorship. So this is a regime where there are elections, multi-party elections, and they're not just a complete and utter sham. We're not talking about Russia today or Belarus today or Venezuela today.
About like Hungary where Viktor Orban does win elections.
We're talking about Hungary today. Right. Or we're talking about Venezuela maybe in the early 2000s or Peru in the 1990s. Arguably India today, maybe even the United States today. I mean, it kind of does seem to be on that path. But they have this really nice line, Levitsky and his co-author, Lucan Wei. They say that on election night, incumbents are forced to sweat. So, you know, the incumbents in competitive authoritarian regimes, the people in power, they don't win 98% of the vote. They don't win 80% of the vote. You know, whenever you see results like that, just dismiss them. They're meaningless. That never happens when there's real competition.
But they might get 55.
They might get 55, yeah. or they might get 51.
Yeah.
There's plausible deniability. So that's what really makes competitive authoritarianism distinct. The playing field is not fair. It is uneven, but it's not a complete and utter sham either.
When you say the playing field is not even or fair, what are you talking about here? Like suppression of media opposition, that kind of thing?
Yeah. So it can mean many things. This can mean a little bit of fraud around the edges, a little bit of coercion around the edges. You know, we're not talking Tiananmen Square massacres, but maybe a journalist disappears. Maybe thugs beat up the main opposition leader. Aggressive use of defamation laws or auditing people who haven't actually cheated on their taxes, but you just want to bankrupt them with legal and accounting fees. Anwar Ibrahim, who is now the prime minister of Malaysia, but previously he was the main opposition leader. He was jailed for several years on sodomy charges, which by all accounts were just made up to tar his reputation and send him to prison. This is called legal repression. And this happens in a lot of competitive authoritarian regimes.
So when you look at what's happening in the United States right at the moment, you said maybe happening in the United States, maybe. There are a lot of people would say there's no maybe about it at the moment.
Yeah.
There's prosecution of people who of his enemies. There are ICE agents going around the streets wearing balaclavas, pulling people off the streets.
Yeah.
Electoral redistribution going on in states like Texas and probably Florida and elsewhere to make it very, very hard for the Democrats to win. What's your assessment of what's happening in the United States right now?
Well, Levitsky and Wei, who developed the term competitive authoritarianism and who are both Americans, but who have spent their whole career studying different parts of the world, Latin America in Levitsky's case, and the post-communist world in Wei's world. They both have now turned the focus on their own country, and they just say emphatically, our country is no longer a democracy. It has crossed the line into competitive authoritarianism. And the really interesting thing, Richard, is that Levitsky in particular is not an alarmist about this stuff. He's not the kind of guy who, you know, in order to get tweets or likes or whatever, you know, is always talking about how countries are sliding into authoritarianism. He actually doesn't think that on a global scale there really is a democratic recession. He doesn't think that the data really backs that up. But he does think that the United States is no longer a democracy. It has slipped into competitive authoritarianism.
What do you see happening in the United States as it's approaching the midterm elections? Because the economy is weakening. Maybe it won't, I don't know. But sooner or later, the effect of Trump's tariff war is going to come home, and most economists think that stagflation is going to be in the United States, where you have both high unemployment and high inflation. Say that happens, and the polls get even worse than they are for Trump right now. What do you expect to see happen in the United States?
I have absolutely no idea. What I will say is this. Competitive authoritarian regimes do not seem to be that stable in the long term. They're very common. Since let's say the 1990s, somewhere between 15 and 20% of every country in the world has probably been competitive authoritarian. But they don't usually remain that way for very long. They either slip into full-blown authoritarianism. That's what happened in Russia. That's what happened in Belarus. That's what happened in Venezuela. Or in happier cases, the competitive authoritarian regime breaks down and they slip back into democracy.
Are you talking about Taiwan, places in South Korea?
I'm talking about Taiwan. I'm talking about Mexico. I'm talking about Peru. Those are the two outcomes. So personally, you know, I care a lot about the United States. I lived there for many years. I have many friends in the United States. I really hope that people will wake up and will do the work necessary to try and save their country's democracy. But the first thing that has to be done in order to do that is just to recognize what has happened. It's not, you know, what might happen, what's at risk of happening. It has already happened.
Watching somewhere like the Czech Republic, I watched it closely. I've got all these personal friendship connections there. You sometimes see in many countries there's going to be the old party of the dictatorship, which was the Communist Party in the case of the Czech Republic. It's not been able to make a comeback. There have been other parties, authoritarian parties, to emerge, but it's not been able to make a comeback. Can the old authoritarian party that once ran the country make a comeback into a genuinely competitive democratic environment and win?
It's extremely common. So this is basically what most of my research is about. I call these parties authoritarian successor parties. So this is when you have a transition to democracy, and I'm talking a real transition, not just, you know, a competitive authoritarian regime or some kind of sham democracy, a real democracy. But then the old ruling party of the former dictatorship continues to exist, continues to run for office, and in many cases returns to power. You know, I started hearing about cases like this in Latin America, the part of the world that I spent a lot of my time thinking about and thinking, this is absolutely bizarre. And then I started realizing this is not just a Latin American thing. You know, in the post-communist world, this is extremely common. Or, you know, in parts of Asia, this is really common. In parts of Africa, this is really common. So I actually put together a data set where I looked at every single new democracy in the world. Again, I'm talking real democracies, not sham democracies, from 1974 until 2010. Then I looked to see, are there one of these authoritarian successor parties and did it return to office? And in nearly three quarters of cases, there was a prominent authoritarian successor party. And then the craziest thing is that in over half of all new democracies, that party returned to office. Voters had the chance to vote for whoever they like. They finally had democratic rights. And what did they do? They used the power of the vote to vote the bad guys, quote unquote, back into office.
You'd think they'd be so on the nose, they'd be hounded out of town. That doesn't happen sometimes.
It happens in some places, but so the Czech Republic is an interesting case, not because it's called the Communist Party of Bohemia and Moravia, not because it continued to exist, and I think it would usually win 10% of the vote or something. What's unusual about it is that it never returned to office. But in, I think, about two-thirds of post-communist democracies in Eastern Europe, Mongolia as well, the party was voted back into office. Sometimes they would change their names, but it was the same thing. The example that I, and actually I start a book that I edited on this topic with this anecdote, because I just think it's amazing. Many people have heard about Solidarity in Poland, you know, this incredible mass movement that emerged in the 1980s to fight communism. It was led by Lech Walesa, who eventually won the Nobel Peace Prize. Many people have heard this story, and they know the climax of the story, which is that in 1989, elections were held, Solidarity was allowed to participate, and they absolutely swept. And
they won every single seat.
Except for one, yeah. I think they lost one Senate seat, but every other seat up for grabs, they won. It's amazing. Poland became a democracy. The next year, Lech Walesa is elected president. That's the end of the story, right? Actually, no. There's an epilogue, and it's a really sad epilogue, which is that in 1993, I think it was, Polish voters seemed to have buyer's remorse. They reversed course, and they voted the Communist Party back into office. Then in 1995, in a very symbolic match between President Walesa and the candidate of the Communist Party, Aleksander Kwaśniewski, voters booted Walesa out, and they voted the Communists back into office. That was just a few years after the return of democracy and Polish voters decided to return the communists to power.
When a dictatorship or an authoritarian regime gets kicked out, they leave behind a terrible mess most of the time. The new Democratic Party's got to come in and clean up that mess. And not everyone likes the bad medicine. I'm mixing my metaphors there, but not everyone likes the bad medicine that they're being asked to take. Maybe that's part of the...
I think that is a big part of it. And one of the things that brings down dictatorship sometimes is that there's an economic crisis. So there's an economic crisis. People punish the people in power, the dictator and the people around him. They vote in the opposition. And it turns out that the opposition can't just magically fix some problem that has probably been accumulating for years, and people get frustrated, and then they forget who actually created that problem initially, and they start to blame the new guys. And then they also start to think kind of nostalgically about the old days, whether their memories of the old days are accurate or not. And they think, you know, back then life was so much easier, and maybe it wasn't, but that's how they remember it.
Just finally, how do you think we're traveling in Australia?
To be honest, I think we're doing great. I don't know if this is just because I'm an immigrant and immigrants are often more patriotic about their adopted country than the people who were born in that country, but I feel extremely grateful to live in Australia. Is this a perfect country? Absolutely not. Is our democracy perfect? Absolutely not.
That doesn't exist, the perfect democracy. No,
but you compare it to really any other democracy in the world, there's no electorally significant far-right, anti-democratic right or anti-democratic left party that is, you know, one election away from potentially taking power. Parties like that exist in much of the rest of the democratic world. But we, you know, here politics is kind of boring. And you know what? Boring is great. It's great to read about revolutions and democratic breakdowns and all of this, but you don't want to live through it. So I feel good about Australia.
I just wonder if so much of your political instinct in pursuing this as a subject comes from you being a shepherd and just looking out to the world and going, don't be a sheep. Is that it? Is this it? Is that why have I hit upon something here, James?
An interesting take, Richard, but I'm not sure you could draw such a clean connecting line there.
Great speaking with you, James, and thank you very much.
Thank you, Richard.
Dr. James Loxton's book is called Authoritarianism, A Very Short Introduction. Today's conversation with James Loxton was made in the lands of the Gadigal people. Producer was Maggie Morris. Executive producer is Nicola Harrison. I'm Richard Feidler. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.